From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. According to business consulting firm analysts, the global market for telemedicine technology stood at $18.7 billion in 2014 and is only expected to grow as healthcare providers and patients increasingly see the benefit of telemedicine applications. We'll explore telemedicine programs being used here in Southwest Florida to address a broad spectrum of health issues, even including very serious conditions such as treating stroke patients. Plus, Florida lawmakers tackled a range of healthcare-related issues in the state legislative session that ended March 11th, ranging from Medicaid eligibility for kids to addressing access to mental health care. We'll explore how bills that passed and bills that failed could impact access to healthcare services. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. During this year's state legislative session, Florida lawmakers by and large continued to oppose expanding Medicaid with federal dollars through the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. That leaves an estimated 800,000 Floridians still in the coverage gap, meaning that they earn too much to qualify for Medicaid, but earn too little to qualify for subsidies through the ACA's insurance marketplace. Even so, state lawmakers did tackle a range of issues impacting healthcare consumers, including an expansion of the Florida Kid Care Program, allowing nurse practitioners and physician assistants to prescribe controlled substances, an increase in spending on mental health care services, and a revamp of mental health care in the state's criminal justice system. For the remainder of the hour, we'll be exploring which bills passed, which bills didn't, and what the impact will be on Florida healthcare consumers. Joining us in studio is Laura Brenneman. She's the Policy and Research Director for the Florida Community Health Action Information Network, that's Florida Chain. She's also a consumer representative on the Florida Health Insurance Advisory Board with the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation, and she's on the State Consumer Health Insurance and Policy Advisory Council for the State Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA. She holds a PhD in philosophy and nursing. Dr. Brenneman, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here, John.
And with us by phone is Pamela Baker. She's recently been named CEO of NAMI of Collier County. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Pamela Baker, thanks for your time today as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I invite listeners to join us, connect with our guests, and join the conversation with your phone calls to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Laura, let's begin with you. As I mentioned, Florida lawmakers by and large remain opposed to Medicaid expansion. Would you say that's the most significant thing that didn't happen in this year's legislative session as it relates to expanding access to healthcare services?
Absolutely, John. There are, as you mentioned, about 800,000 Floridians in the coverage gap. But I have to point out that those are working age adults who earn less than 138% of the federal poverty level. But many of those don't earn too much to qualify for Medicaid. They're just not categorically eligible. In our state, people have to meet a categorical eligibility to qualify for Medicaid. So somebody who is not a parent and not disabled can't earn too much money to qualify for Medicaid. They just don't get it at all.
Gotcha, gotcha. So it's more than just income. That's a good thing to point out. You know, what would accepting the federal dollars and expanding Medicaid mean here in Florida? And by that I mean, what impact would it have on healthcare consumers, even if they're already covered by private insurance or Medicaid or Medicare? I mean, wouldn't it impact costs across the board?
Well, certainly. Florida is passing up about $71 billion over the next 10 years by not accepting the money to return back to our state that would increase jobs, give a boost to the economy. And we're not just talking about jobs in the healthcare sector. It's jobs across all sectors that we're turning down.
And, you know, as you know, Louisiana recently became the 31st state to accept federal funding to expand Medicaid. And the federal government is still looking to lure Florida in. Initially, the federal government had proposed fully funding Medicaid expansion for states that chose to participate through 2016. And now President Obama has proposed extending that 100% matching rate for 3 years for, you know, states like Florida if they should decide to newly expand. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but do you think that helped convince lawmakers to take this up next year?
Well, we're hopeful that our lawmakers will continue to explore this and take this up. I'm not certain that the federal offer of 100% federal match is likely to be extended based on it requiring congressional approval as well.
Okay.
But it's fair to say that the match for the federal match for Medicaid dollars under the expanded eligibility program of the Affordable Care Act will remain much above what we certainly currently see in our Medicaid match because it will never drop below 90%.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, Florida has led the nation in the number of people signing up for coverage through the federal healthcare marketplace among states that haven't expanded Medicaid. Do you think that signals some kind of, you know, disconnect between state lawmakers who don't want to participate in the program and their constituents?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Certainly, Florida has led the nation in enrollment in the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. And it highlights the point that there are so many people in Florida who had no access to health coverage prior to 2014. And despite that, we still lead the nation in the rate of people without coverage in that working age adult area.
All right. And Florida did approve a limited expansion in eligibility for coverage through the Florida Kid Care Program. Tell us about that.
Well, in 2009, the Congress, when they reauthorized the CHIP program, gave states the authority to waive the 5-year waiting period for lawfully residing children to enroll in Medicaid or the children's health insurance plans. And it took 7 years for Florida to take the federal government up on that offer with an enhanced match rate where the federal government is providing 95% of the expenses for enrolling those children. So this year we are so grateful that approximately 17,000 deserving children in Florida will now have access to health care coverage.
And the increased cost that the program will incur because of that's going to be covered by federal government?
The federal government picks up 95% of the cost to cover those children. But Florida will likely actually see some benefits, net benefits and net gains from that, because Florida has been covering the children who need emergency services under Florida-only funds, and they won't have to spend that money any longer.
All right. And there was a piece of failed legislation related to the Children's Medical Service Network, or CMS. Tell us about that and kind of what the trend with CMS has been.
What's gone on with CMS in the turn to our Medicaid managed care program over the last couple of years was a change in the way children were being screened to be eligible for the service. CMS was designed to serve children who have special health care needs. But with the authorizing legislation to the Medicaid managed care program in 2011, the verbiage was changed to say not just children who had chronic special health care needs, but to say they had to have serious and chronic special health care needs. Hmm. When the Department of Health instituted a new screening tool to evaluate those children, the screening tool that they employed defined that serious as meaning the children had to have functional limitations. And as a result, 9,000 children were screened out of the CMS program. That was challenged in the courts because that the screening tool was not promulgated by rule, and CMS has since repromulgated a rule, but they continue to use a screening tool that continues to define serious as meaning a functional limitation. So the proposed legislation simply was to eliminate that word serious, so we could have children who have special health care needs get services to prevent them from developing those limitations.
I see. We're taking a closer look at the recently concluded state legislative session as it relates to health care issues and Floridians' access to quality health care services. We're talking with Laura Brenneman with Florida Chain and Pamela Baker with the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Collier County. Connect with our guests with your comments and questions by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Pamela Baker with NAMI, let's bring you into the conversation now. How would you characterize this year's legislative session when it comes to issues related to access to mental health care services?
Well, I've been involved in the mental health system in this area for approximately 26 years. And I have to say this is one of the most encouraging legislative sessions I've seen. New funding for mental health programs that hasn't been seen before. You know, with that said, though, the decision not to move into Medicaid expansion is very, very disappointing, and it means a lot to people with mental illnesses. There are most of the people, I believe, a good majority of the people who are eligible for that Medicaid expansion are people with mental illnesses. And as most people know, if you don't treat mental illnesses, it significantly can increase costs, especially to counties at the jail and the hospital level.
All right. You did mention we saw that funding increase. And as the chair of the Florida Supreme Court's Task Force on Substance Abuse and Mental Illness noted, that's the first time we've seen an increase in those dollars in about a decade. What does that say about where Florida ranks nationally when it comes to funding for mental health care services?
You know, for as long as I can remember, we've been at least 49th. I think once we dipped into the 50th among the states in per capita mental health funding. This may move us up a tad, but as far as states go, $60 million sounds a lot, but it doesn't go that far, especially because some of the new dollars will be spent on deep-end services that are extremely costly.
What does that mean, deep-end
services? So state mental institutions and things like that, rather than the lower-cost preventative community-based services.
All right. Well, Governor Scott did sign a couple of mental health reforms into law already, including a revamp of mental health care within Florida's criminal justice system. Can you maybe, Pamela, give us a little background on the current situation regarding Florida prisons and people suffering from mental illness?
People, obviously, with mental illnesses are arrested more often than they should be. They're acting on symptoms of their mental illness. They're not necessarily knowing what they're doing when they're arrested. And Florida has been very good with implementing mental health courts over the last several years. I think probably the last almost two decades we started implementing mental health courts. And that just means that there's a special docket at the court for people who have been arrested and have a mental illness. They were screened when they go into the jail, and then as soon as possible they're moved over into that docket. And in those mental health courts, they're very different than your general mainstream court processes. And it's intended that the people that are in the mental health courts are there to get treatment and get back into the community as quickly as possible and out of the jail. Because obviously jails are not the optimal place for someone with a serious mental illness. I believe in the new legislation, the new budget, we have several mental health courts, several counties being funded with mental health court dollars. Some of it's recurring and some of it not recurring. And in many of those communities, they've had mental health court for some time. It's just finally giving them an increase in that funding, or it's the mental health system providing the funding rather than the counties, where I think a lot of the funding for operating the mental health courts has come from in the past.
And were there any other significant measures that passed or failed when it comes to addressing access to mental health care services here in the Sunshine State?
One that comes to mind was some additional money for what's called a children's community action team. Mm-hmm. Those are very, very successful teams in which a psychiatrist and a counselor and a case manager provide wraparound services to families with a child who has a serious mental health problem. And this is one of the more preventative measures. It prevents those children from going into what we call a psychiatric, statewide inpatient psychiatric program that are very, very costly services. So we can keep those children in the community now, hopefully, and not have them move away from their families and into these institutional settings just because they have a mental illness. Now we are able to, through the CAT teams, work with the family while the child's in their home. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a really exciting thing that they refunded a few more of those teams.
And you know, Pamela, in conversations I had and in, you know, quotes I'd read from other news articles regarding, you know, members of Southwest Florida's state legislative delegation, you know, multiple folks said that, you know, addressing mental health issues was going to be a priority for them in the session that just ended. Are you hopeful more that, you know, state lawmakers are perhaps becoming, I guess, more literate in terms of mental health issues and where Florida is right now?
I think, as far as I'm concerned, our local legislators are very on top of the issue. In fact, Kathleen Pasadomo took it upon herself to ask for some special funding for Southwest Florida, specifically for a early intervention program for children's mental health in Collier County. Although that didn't go through, she did go out way out there, I think, and tried to help as much as she could. But yeah, can we improve? Absolutely. And then that might be some of us to help provide that education. So that's one of the things that NAMI does. We'll provide education to the community so that people, including our lawmakers, understand the issues.
Gotcha. Well, we're taking a closer look at the recently concluded state legislative session as it relates to health care issues and Floridians' access to health care. We're talking with Laura Brenneman with Florida Chain and Pamela Baker with NAMI of Collier County. You can connect with us with your comments and questions by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Laura, we saw the passage of a measure this year expanding prescription authority for physician assistants and nurse practitioners. What will they be able to prescribe now that they hadn't been authorized to do in the past? And I guess, what's the situation here with Florida? Why are we the last state to allow this?
We are absolutely the last state, and this has been a bill that's been being pursued since 1995. So it's been a long time coming. And nurse practitioners in particular, but both nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, offer an opportunity to improve access to health care and especially primary care services. What this bill will do is allow those practitioners the authority to prescribe controlled substances to their patients. And that will enable them to see patients, especially patients in rural or vulnerable populations that didn't have those kinds of accesses before.
What do you think the barriers to this have been? I mean, nearly 20 years. I think more recently maybe the pill mill crisis might have made lawmakers a little shaky on the idea of expanding who can prescribe opiates, but that certainly wouldn't explain going back to the 90s.
You know, this is really a turf war between different healthcare providing disciplines, and the measure had been blocked largely over the last 22 years through a very strong medical lobby.
Gotcha. You know, and lawmakers also approved a proposal for Florida to join the Nurse Licensure Compact, you know, making it easier for nurses to work across state lines and, you know, other states that are part of this agreement. When this bill becomes law, you know, it sounds like it'd be good for nurses, but Florida Chain's legislative report card doesn't seem to indicate it would, you know, have much impact on the number of nurses working in the state. Why is that?
So what this bill does, when it becomes effective, and it won't become effective until 2018 or until 26 states approve the measure, but what happens is it allows nurses to use a license that's issued in their state of home residence to practice in other states. We don't see that as being something that's going to increase the supply of nurses necessarily in the state. What it might do is make it a bit more fluid and easier, especially in areas like Southwest Florida, where a lot of nurses do come seasonally and where the local hospitals will have more flexibility in bringing those nurses to the state more quickly, because getting the license as you go back and forth, it's quite a time delay.
Sure, sure. And, you know, Florida is one of the top five states when it comes to employing nurses, but at a lower average pay rate compared to some other states. You know, for example, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics finds that in 2014, the average pay for nurses in Florida stood at about $63,000 a year, compared to more than $68,000 in Texas and more than $98,000 in California. Given that, do you think that Florida joining this multi-state compact might actually drive nurses out of Florida?
It certainly could. It certainly could make it much easier for nurses who live in Florida to travel and work in those higher paying states. So there is a potential. Maybe it will shift the wages for nurses in the state, too.
Interesting. Interesting. And lawmakers approved a measure aimed at improving transparency in healthcare pricing. Tell us what this bill does and or what it's trying to set up and, you know, how that might impact access to care. Or at least, you know, consumer information.
So after that bill gets signed, and I do need also to note that the nurse prescribing law has not yet been signed by the governor either.
Okay.
We do anticipate that it will be, along with the transparency bill. But the point of that bill is to empower consumers to know better what care costs and what the quality measures of that care is. And enabling the consumers to be better purchasers, to seek care that has high quality and value for their what it costs.
All right, and you know, when it comes to consumers' pocketbooks, another bill that passed was regarded out-of-network care. Tell us about that, because that seems, you know, pretty significant, and I think anybody who's had to get emergency care out of state has probably experienced this.
So that was a huge win for Florida consumers, and we at Florida Chain are actually quite excited and quite proud that that bill did pass this year. That puts Florida in the forefront in terms of some of the health aspects of insurance coverage, which is not a position we enjoy very frequently. So what this bill does is it takes the consumer or the patient out of the mix when a consumer does everything right that they're supposed to under their insurance rules. If you have a PPO and you look up and you say, well, I need to get my hip replaced, for instance, and you find an orthopedic surgeon who's in your network and you schedule to have that surgery at the hospital that's in your network, but you have no opportunity to choose which anesthesiologist is going to deliver, you know, put you to sleep for the surgery, or what radiologist is going to read that x-ray. And frequently, they are not in your network, but they're contracted by the hospital, and there's no choice on the part of the patient. And so consumers have been subject to very high amounts of balance billing under those circumstances. And what this bill does is it protects consumers who do everything right and seek care at an in-network hospital, whether it's an emergency situation or not, they will no longer be subject to those high out-of-network balance billing.
All right. And is Florida ahead of the pack on this issue, or do other states – have other states picked up on this as well?
New York did pass a bill about a year and a half ago to do this, but they did that with a pretty elaborate scheme to resolve the dispute then between the provider and the payer. And Florida's legislation actually went, I think, a bit further. They didn't make anything prescriptive in terms of that dispute resolution process. They just said to them, you guys have to work it out, but the consumer shouldn't be held accountable. The consumer is held harmless in those situations. So, yeah, Florida is at the forefront there.
All right. And a bill that failed in this year's session would have eliminated the need for AHCA to approve a certificate of need before a new healthcare facility like a hospital could be built. Would this have had much impact on Floridians' access to health care, do you think?
You know, the research, the evidence about certificate of need is pretty ambivalent. There is not any definitive answer to that question as far as whether that increases the availability of services or reduces prices and increases quality. There's really no good answer to that question, as Florida Chain did not really take a position on that one.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm thinking about it. And on the one hand, I can understand why some state oversight could be good for assuring that hospitals get constructed where they're actually needed. But on the other hand, just yesterday, the city of Northport, city commissioners there gave up on their effort to apply for a certificate of need for a hospital. And it's the fastest growing city in that county. Mm-hmm. And you know, now there likely won't be there one for years or possibly even decades because Sarasota Memorial is looking to build one in a nearby town. So it just I can see that going both ways, and I can understand why the research on that would be ambivalent.
Yeah, the research is really unclear, and partially I think that's due to how the certificate of need programs get implemented across the states that continue to have them, because it is a very political process.
And Fort Myers State Representative Heather Fitzenhagen brought back her proposal this year to allow ambulatory surgery centers to keep patients for up to 3 days after an operation, something that currently, as I understand it, would have to happen in a hospital. What would the impact of that bill been if it had passed?
Well, that recovery care center project really would have created entities that are very similar in appearance to a specialty care hospital, like an orthopedic hospital. Mm-hmm. And there's really been a moratorium on building new physician-owned specialty hospitals, which is what those by and large are under the Affordable Care Act, with the rationale that they cherry-pick low-risk, high-paying patients away from the community hospitals and siphon off essential funds from our safety net and essential community providers. So I think it's probably a very good thing that we did not see that bill pass.
All right. Well, Representative Fitzenhagen herself had touted that bill, saying it would give patients more options as to where to get their treatment. They could shop for better prices, and maybe they weren't even terribly comfortable going into a hospital and would feel safer in a potentially less germ-infested surgery center than a hospital. What would be your response to that kind of argument?
I would say that it likely would give lots of patients choices who already have an abundance of choices. But for patients who currently don't have a choice, there's 3 million Floridians that remain without health insurance. It would have been a huge imposition on them.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. But thanks so much to my guests. We've been speaking with Laura Brenneman. She's the Policy and Research Director for Florida CHAIN. That's the Community Health Action Information Network. Great to have you in studio.
Thank you, John. It's been my pleasure.
We've also been speaking with Pamela Baker, CEO of NAMI of Collier County. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Great to connect with you as well.
Thank you.
And there's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and AJ Leonard. This is WGCU FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.